Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's.
Hey everybody, Shane Terrio here, joining you again, and thank you for joining me on the Riff Raff. How are you? I'm doing great, thank you for asking. You're listening to a track called F Thing from my record Still Motion. Sitting here soaking up some of this Southern California weather, beautiful. Been out here for a few months, checking it out. What a nice change of weather. Yeah, I just wanted to say briefly, I have a new website. I partnered up with the fine people at Reward Music. It's ShaneTerrio.com. Come check it out. Got a lot of great new music up there. I have a new EP download. I have some new instructional materials. I have some lessons. A lot of neat things. Come sign up. Doesn't cost anything to sign up. If you want a little extra, I do have a Mojo VIP membership, which you can check out if you're so inclined. Anyway, let's get to today's guest. As always, hit me up on Instagram, Facebook, Shane Terrio Music. Leave me a good review on iTunes. Let's get to today's guest.
Thing.
Okay, we're gonna do a brand new song for you right now. This will be on our next record. This one's called Bad News.
My guest today is Scott Sherrard. Scott is a really great bluesy player, great singer, songwriter, originating from Michigan, but he's been a New Yorker for many, many years. Scott's probably best known for being a member of Greg Allman's band, and not just a sideman. He wrote some songs with Greg, which we'll get into. You'll hear a few of them. And as of late, he has taken on the role of becoming a member of Little Feat. And you'll hear about that. I mean, these were both Duane Allman and Lil George were like basically his heroes growing up. So it's very cool that he's stepped into both of their shoes. Little backstory, Scott and I actually did this interview probably late spring of 2020, but right when coronavirus started, but the audio was so bad I couldn't actually find, get myself to post it. So we redid the interview, and it's not perfect, but it's much, much better. And that's why I don't like doing things remotely on Riff Raff, but to get somebody like Scott on here, that's what has to happen. And thank you again, Scott, for your patience. He's got some great stories, great life lessons in this one. I think you'll enjoy it. So let's get started. Here we go. Scott Sherrard. Thanks for listening.
Riff Raff.
Scott, thank you for joining me once again. This is why I haven't done any riff raffs remote, but you know, when I want to have a guest like Scott on right now with the coronavirus limitations, this is the only way to make it happen. So unfortunately, he's my guinea pig today and we're trying this new software out, but he's such a sport because we did this interview months ago and I apologize. It just wasn't up to sonic standards that I like to have here on the podcast, Scott. And I thought you deserved better.
Thanks for giving another swing at it. You may hear my kids every once in a while in the background, but I'm sure everyone's used to that by now.
You're from Michigan originally, right, Scott?
Yeah, I was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then I was raised there and in Dearborn. And then basically the balance of my childhood, I was raised throughout the Rust Belt. It was almost like a Rust Belt tour because you know, from the age of 9, I went to Minneapolis, and then I went from there to Newtown, Pennsylvania. And then I went from there, when I was a sophomore in high school, I went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and then graduated from high school of the arts in Milwaukee. And about a year after that, I made my way to New York City. I've been here ever since. But, you know, I'm basically a child of the Rust Belt, but both my parents are from Michigan.
Gotcha. And Michigan's produced a lot of great music. I mean, well, Ann Arbor, I think of Ted Nugent, but also there's Bob Seger. And I mean, of course, the whole Detroit scene. There's a lot of great musicians come from that area.
Yeah, man. It's like everything from, you know, John Lee Hooker was from Detroit. And then obviously Motown is probably the greatest export.
Motown, sure.
And then from there, you got, the MC5. I mean, there's an incredible, incredible music scene. I mean, I could go on all day about. And I was, you know, my dad is a guitar player, singer, songwriter, and has been, you know, in and out of the business throughout his life, mostly out of it. But when I was born, it kind of drove him out of it for economic reasons. But he was really active in the music scene there from his teen years all the way through his mid-20s. And one of his mentors was this guy, Russ Gibb, who's legendary in the Detroit music scene. He had a club called the Grandy Ballroom, and that was like the Fillmore. He was like the Bill Graham of the Midwest, this guy Russ. And Russ was my babysitter when I was a little kid, so he would play me Bobby Bland records and stuff. And I have a lot of fond memories of being in Michigan, even though I was only there from birth until 9 years of age.
Yeah, well, that's the formative years, man. I remember a lot of things from early on, too. I mean, those are the things that stick with you, I think. How old were you when you went to New York? Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you went with a band, right?
Well, yeah.
You guys all moved together?
I went actually with my friend Sean Dixon, who we had a band called the Chesterfields in Milwaukee. And we moved. It was the summer of 96, August 96. I was probably about 20 years old. And we got an apartment with our friend. We got one of the coveted, you'll know about this because you did your time in New York City. We had one of the coveted rent-controlled apartments in the East Village.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
I've heard of those mythical things, but they don't exist when I was there. They
yeah, I think exist. You probably made it there too late, but we... Trust me, we paid for it. You know, we had some skin in the game. You know, there were a lot of people passed out with needles in their arm in the doorway, and you know, it was real shit. The methadone clinic was a half a block away. It was on 13th Street and First Avenue.
Yeah, I was going to say it's like Alphabet City-ish around there, right?
Yeah,
Tompkins Square Park.
This was sort of the beginning of what they used to call, you know, Giuliani time, which has taken on a whole new meaning today. But that's this was just as that whole movement to sort of Starbucksify and Gapify and Rite Aidify the city was just starting. So I kind of caught the very, very end of the rough, you know, rough and tumble artistic East Village loft scene and stuff. And it was great. I mean, when I moved in, my apartment was across the street from Allen Ginsberg's apartment. And, you know, I used to go get Chinese food at the place on the corner and see Allen and say hi to him. And for me, it was like, you know, I've been a fan of the Beatniks since I was in my early teens. And that was just unbelievable for, you know, a kid from coming from Milwaukee to living across the street from Allen Ginsberg. That was enough for me, even if I had to work a day job.
Yeah, New York's like, obviously I didn't live there as long as you, but I think I got the vibe and got into the groove after a while. And it struck me as being like one big neighborhood, basically. It's like a cozy neighborhood, and it's like Seinfeld. You see the same people on your block, and, you know, and it's such a densely populated thing where you run into a lot of notables and musicians, and it is a special place.
No doubt. It's been like this forever, man. I mean, it's New Orleans is like that too. I mean, Memphis, Nashville, New Orleans, LA has its own thing. New York's just another one of those. And I'd argue with New York, it's probably what's come on top in New York is really the jazz, you know, jazz and hip hop. I mean, it's kind of the capital of that, which are two musical genres I'm a huge fan of, but I have really no active involvement in. So right. I do a lot more hanging out here, honestly, going to restaurants and hanging out in jazz clubs than I do actually working here, you know? Most of my work is done on the road, outside of the studio stuff. And even the studio stuff, increasingly, I'll go to Louisiana or especially Memphis or Nashville to do work now. And you know all about that, you know?
Right. Yeah, sure. Well, I love that name, the Chesterfields. It reminds me of some like 1960s name or something. Yeah, that's a pretty unusual name for a band in the, would you say, 90s or late 80s, 90s?
Well, we were unusual guys. still are. No, I mean, like I used to, you know, I was into, as I said, I was into beat poetry, and I was into all kinds of like literature and music and art. And I went to an arts high school in Milwaukee. And when I got there, it kind of just opened up the whole playing field, because we had everything from sort of the best like gospel R&B musicians in the Midwest to, you know, the blues legends like Hubert Sumlin and Pine Top Perkins, who used to hang out at this jam session that I would go to. And I ended up playing with them in a bunch of situations. Buddy Miles was another local. But, you know, I used to wear gabardine shirts and smoked unfiltered cigarettes. And my
Chesterfield.
Yeah, that was my brand, was Chesterfield Kings. And, you know, I was the only guy with a 1965 Super Reverb and a reissue 335. And everyone else had, you know, Mesa Boogie amps and, you know, Strats. And I was like trying to hang like the old guys. So I figured, hey, at 15, I'm like, I'm just going to smoke. I'm taking the filters out. You know, I'm going to smoke Chesterfield Kings. And then when I started my own band, when I was 16, I was offered this gig every Thursday at this amazing club called the Up and Under, which was like the salon. That's the place where all the Luther Allison and like I said, Hubert and Pine Top used to hang out there. And that was the joint. And all the best local guys used to play there. And I got my own gig with my own band. They wanted to know what I wanted to call it. And I was on the phone with the owner, and I looked down at my desk in my childhood bedroom, and I had a pack of Chesterfield Kings on the table.
that's called it. That. Correct name, Chesterfield.
So we called it Chesterfield Kings, and then Sean and I shortened it later because we found out, this is very pre-internet, but we found out, we started having these angry guys showing up at our gigs. It turns out the Chesterfield Kings was a punk band from Canada.
That sounds like a doo-wop band from Canada. It's like the scene in Blues Brothers. It's like, we're the good old boys. They show up and fake.
It's along those lines for sure. Except some of these guys were skinheads, so it was a little scary when they would show up and be mad that it wasn't the Chesterfield Kings from Canada. But we got through it.
How did you get before I ask you about Greg Allman, tell me something that happened when you got to New York that was sort of a game changer for you.
You mean
just mad or a gig or anything like that?
Well, I can tell you, as far as like gig stuff, I mean, I vividly remember my first missed opportunity. Because when I got there, you know, Sean Dixon and I, you know, the drummer from the Chesterfields, Sean also plays like keys and bass, and he's a great songwriter and arranger. He's worked a lot recently with Michelle and Degacello, and he's just an incredible musician, and we're still great friends. But he's the musician I moved from Milwaukee to New York with. And we were really struggling, and we were going to jam sessions. We were picking up gigs here and there on Bleecker Street. You know, that whole scene. We were trying to work our way up to the Bitter End and Terra Blues from Kenny's Castaways, if you remember that place. And we were roughing it. And I got a musician heard me a great session guitar player, and I'll save his name for the story, but he heard me at a club and he said, look, I'm going to give you my card, and if I need a sub, I'll give you a call. And I was about 20. And now I went to an arts high school, but I always got away with playing by ear because I've always been able to play back whatever anyone plays to me. So I skimmed on the reading. And one day, I'd say within weeks of him giving me that card, I was checking in with him. And he goes, oh, yeah, I got a session tomorrow. He's like, so you can sight read, and you have like a nylon string guitar, and you're going to need a Stratocaster, and you're going to, and I'm like, oh my God, I don't have any of this stuff and I can't read. and he's like, yeah, it paid, you know, it was like, it paid a lot of money at the time, you know, $500, $1,000, whatever it was. I remember it was like, you know, it would have gotten close to covering my rent for the month, that mm-hmm. one session that would have probably taken 2 hours. And I said, I can't do it. I have none of these things. And he's like, oh man, I can't ever call you for work again. And I was like, okay, now wait a second. I need to get my business in order. And I tell you, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, was that first experience. That was one of my
Did you show up and just bombed, or you didn't make it at all? And he told you
that, oh no, I was straight up with him. You know, I'm a Midwestern boy, man. I'm honest to a fault. You know, so I just copped right away. I was like, man, I can't do any of that. I don't have any of that gear, you know, at the time. You know, I can't read music. I can't cut it, man. I'm not going to be able to do it. And I had to suck it up. And you know what I did? I went and took some lessons for the first time in my life, besides what I learned, you know, from my dad and on stage and in dressing rooms from great guitar players. I went and sat with Vic Juris for a couple of weeks. You remember him?
Yes, I do.
He was teaching.
Didn't he pass away recently?
He did. He did. May he rest in peace. He was a great mentor to so many musicians in New York. But I went to the New School. I took a couple privates with him, and they were expensive, but they were worth it. And he got me on that William Levitt reading series. And
okay, Berkeley still.
Yeah, he got me on that, and he listened to me play. I'd go in and I'd play with him, and he'd be like, yeah, your problem is not the playing. He's like, what do you want? And I was like, you know, I really need to understand what I'm doing. And at like the second or third lesson, we got to the end, and he was like, all right, you're done. Save your money. Take these books. Study them. You're going to be fine. That's what I did. I spent the next year just studying those books, and I taught myself to read. I taught myself theory, and it all worked out in the end.
Oh, great. That's a great story. I mean, it could have went the other way. You could have showed up at the session and totally bombed and probably burned a bridge, and maybe you wouldn't have got those lessons, you know. So it was very smart of you at the time to have the foresight to go try to improve your chops, you know.
Well, if I only have one talent, it's that I really know how to respect and listen to my mentors. And it's probably what's driven me into being a member of their bands over and over again. It's just, I try to listen and learn as much as I can. And I always try to surround myself with people who are better than me at as many things as possible. And I thrive on collaboration as a result. And I think if there's one thing that is possible to be God-given that I have, it's just sometimes I get lucky and I know when to shut up and learn the right lesson, you know?
I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I think that those opportunities, unfortunately, aren't as present as they were, you know, maybe in the 80s and 90s, because, you know, we were both lucky. And it was almost like an apprenticeship, you know, like when I started playing with the Nevilles, it was school, you know, and if you're lucky enough to get on a gig or any of the great people you played with too before you left Milwaukee and Michigan, I mean, that's stuff that you can't learn in a book or off of a video or something. I don't know, younger players today, I think they have a little bit more of a challenge trying to get together. Not that there's not great music being made, but it's just a different way. The apprenticeship thing is different now.
The only thing I would encourage, and I'm starting to see this more and more, is just, you know, pay attention to the material. You know, we've had a big problem with songs, and we also have the even bigger problem is just people figuring out how to rise above the noise of so much content in so many genres of music without an arbiter of taste. I mean, the music industry without Atlantic Records and Warner Brothers Records in the 60s and 70s, I mean, it's a huge loss for bands that have talent that they don't get to partake in a, you know, in this sort of this system where there's an arbiter of culture and, you know, the masses pay attention because of that. Now it's like the masses have too much of everything. And
yeah, there's no quality control anywhere. Yeah. I mean, that's a subjective thing. I know it's a matter of taste, but, you know, everything is out all at one time now.
I think music's really, really exciting right now. It just doesn't, you know, I'm 43 years old and it just doesn't touch me as much as I respect it, as much as I enjoy it. There are some artists out there who absolutely blow me away, but unfortunately most of them, you know, nobody knows who they are, especially in America.
Right.
You know, there's guys out, like my favorite guitar players out there who no one knows about, I mean, or should, is like, you know, Dan Littleton, my friend here in Woodstock. I mean, he's just the most soulful, unbelievable, beautiful individual voice. And he plays with Amy Helm. He's on her records and she's a good friend and sometimes collaborator. And so is Dan. I mean, they're both on my new record that I'm working on. But I mean, that guy, another guy is Jeffrey Lockhart. You know this cat?
I don't know.
Oh my God, man. He teaches at Berkeley, but like, this is one of the most tasteful, incredible, funky, like just tone. He's just got it all. I mean, it's like this cat is just off the charts. Another one is Garrett Mason. He's up in Canada. You know, he's like in Fredericton, mm-hmm. New Brunswick. And Garrett's one of the most blues playing cats out there. Like his dad's a famous, he passed away. His father passed away, but his father is a famous blues musician, harmonica player, singer from Canada named Dutchie Mason. And he passed away a number of years ago, but I did that Harvest Jazz and Blues Festival with my band a couple times. And each time I've been on there with Garrett and he blows me away every time. But I mean, those are just a couple examples of, you know, people who your listeners may not be familiar with, but it's like when I hear those guys play, I'm listening like huge ears. Like I'm excited. And then I love these Canadians, man. It's like Ariel Posen and Joey Landreth. I mean, these guys they're incredible.
Jeff Healy.
He's one of the dons of that, you know, scene. Yeah. I mean, Neil Young, you know, I mean,
he was such a great player, Jeff Healy.
Yeah. He was, I saw him live when I was a kid, actually. I couldn't get over the fact of how he was playing the guitar. It made no sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. There's another, well, since we're talking about the friendly Canadians, I have a lot of Canadian friends. There's a, you know, that Katie Lang record, Ingenue. There's Ben Mink, who, like, I don't know much about him, but man, the production on that record alone is just phenomenal. You know, he plays all these different instruments. So I don't know. I'd like to meet him sometime.
I mean, I have a cursory knowledge of their scene up there, and it is somewhat state sponsored, and they're just incredibly, they have a music community. You know, we're so fractured here in the US, you know, we're playing by so many rules that don't exist anymore, in every aspect of being musicians in the United States. It's just insane. Kind of like a lot of things that we do here. You know, we're playing with an old rule book.
Right. I didn't even know those rules. So I don't even know what's going on anymore.
Well, the good news is you used to not have to know them because there was always someone who'd show up and take care of all that stuff for you. But now everything's our problem, you know?
from getting lessons from Vic Juris and getting your crap together and your equipment and your tone and all. I'm sure you already had it together, but you know, really bumping it up to the next level to Greg Allman.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, my Beatles and Rolling Stones, okay, as much as I love and adore the Beatles and Rolling Stones, but my personal Beatles and Rolling Stones were the Allman Brothers and Little Feat from when mm-hmm. I was like 8 years old. So my life's journey has been leading up to these gigs, and I don't know how this all happened. I never expected to, you know, become part of these families, both these families, but it is what has come to pass. And, you know, in particular, my connection as a very young kid, like I said, at 8 or 9 years old, hearing those records, hearing Waiting for Columbus in particular, and the first two Allman Brothers studio albums in particular, you know, my heroes immediately became Greg Allman, Duane Allman, and Lowell George in particular, because right. as a singer and guitar player already at that young age, and seeing my father as a singer guitar player and being raised around musicians, it became abundantly clear to me immediately that these guys were like me. They were middle-class white kids who fell in love with the blues, but they were also seeing foreign films and reading these novels and hanging out with all kinds of people and going to juke joints and doing all kinds of different shit that just deepened their knowledge and experience as human beings. And their forms of rock and roll became kind of a salon of experience and curation. And, you know, on a cellular level, that all hit me right away. Cause I was, you know, by the time I was 10 and I was playing guitar, I had a poster of Chuck Berry on my wall and I was reading Mad Magazine, and that music was like the perfect soundtrack to all that. You know, it's like, it all fit my lifestyle and my beliefs. And, you know, I could hear Coltrane, I could hear Muddy Waters, I could hear Chuck Berry, I could hear Hank Williams. It was all in the mix.
Right.
So I went on a lot of different side trips in my life with music, especially, you know, with the local guys in Milwaukee who were real blues men from the South. Another guy was a guy named Stokes who passed away last year, who was my main mentor. And I would do anything for Stokes. I used to play drums in his band. I'd play bass in his band. I played guitar and sang with him. But I was literally like a chef in the South of France trying to stage, and I would clean the damn gutters for this guy if I had to. So all that led up to me meeting Greg. And the sort of in-between, I call them my lost years from the age of like 20 to 30, right? My 20s were basically spent trying to get into a record business that didn't exist anymore. And I was mentored by Ahmet Erdogan. I was entertained by Russ Teitelman and a bunch of, you know, heroes of mine on the production and music side of the business, but they never led to any financial deals. And when I was 30, I'd been doing this regular gig with my good friend Jay Collins in his band all around New York in those clubs, you know, like 55 Bar, Little Places, Smalls, playing in his band, which was like a mix of blues and rock and jazz. And he kept telling me he'd been playing with Greg Allman for a long time. And he said, I got to get you in Greg's band. And man, it went on for years. He said this to me. So probably when I was about 28, he started saying this to me. When I was 30, one day he called me and he goes, hey man, I'm taking you to Camden, New Jersey. The Allman Brothers are playing there and you're going to sit in, and this is your audition. I said, oh, it's finally really happening. And I went, I met Greg and went straight to his dressing room. And right away, you know, he flipped around, stuck his hand out, and he's like, Scotty, it's such a pleasure to meet you, man. You know, need anything to drink? You know, it's just total Southern hospitality right off the bat, as you would expect. And then he goes, listen, man, you got to tell me one thing. Do you know all those Wayne Bennett licks on those Bobby Bland records? And that was the moment where my childhood experience kind of came into play, because I knew everything on those Bobby Bland records. From playing with Harvey Scales and Willie Higgins and Stokes and those guys. I mean, they used to beat me up to learn how to play like Wayne did on Stormy Monday, where you're playing off the voice and you have that call and response, that style, that Memphis blues style from the 50s and 60s, you know?
Right.
So when we got on stage to jam, I started throwing some of that at him. And he started laughing and slapping his leg. And we walked off the stage and he's like, you got the gig, bro. Let's do this. And that was it. And we were off and running. That was like summer of 2008. And then eventually I became his MD and we wrote a few songs together. And one of them did really well. Made a couple records. We had a hell of a run. And then he passed away in 2017. But
okay, so you were with him for... What is that? That's
almost a decade, about 9 years.
Almost a decade. Yeah, 9 years. Yeah. 2008, 2017. Yeah.
We had a hell of a time, man.
Why don't you tell the story? I remember now the last failed interview we did. Tell the story about playing Dwayne's guitar.
Well, I've gotten to play it on several occasions, but the first occasion was definitely the most dramatic event for me. We were in Macon, Georgia with Greg Allman Band, and this was again pretty early in my tenure in the band. It was probably like 2011, I want to say. So it's right, you know, it was right before I started becoming the music director and we started hanging all the time. So I was still a little nervous about my relationship with Greg as, you know, quote unquote my boss. But, you know, even that said, I mean, he was the easiest guy to hang out with. But there were certain subjects where you were just careful. And obviously his brother was one of them because his brother always hung over the project because his brother was, you know, his greatest inspiration and kind of his father figure. And he would talk about him all the time. And obviously his brother's guitar, Dwayne Allman's first Les Paul, which is a gold top Les Paul, I think it's 57. It used to live at the Big House Museum in Macon, Georgia. It's no longer there. That's another story. But it was there at the time in 2011, and we were there doing a week of shows in Macon, Georgia at the Opera House. So Greg Allman's best friend, Chank Middleton, who's literally been with Greg since the first Allman Brothers rehearsal, which was in the basement of the barber shop where Chank was cutting hair. Yeah, that's how deep Chank is in the history. And Chank is the most unbelievable cat, man. Like we've been in touch all throughout this year. And, I go see him at least once a year. I called him the spirit animal of the Greg Allman Band. He just embodied so much knowledge and love and soul as a human being. And just made going to work great every day. And Chank was there every day. And one day Chank said to me while we were in Macon, I think we played one show, and he said to me the next day, he's like, I told him I went to the Big House and played the guitar, and I was absolutely blown away by the instrument. And I told him, and he goes, yeah, man, you should play that guitar on the gig tonight. And I said, well, Chank, you know, I've heard that Greg doesn't really like people playing his brother's guitars at this point. He has mixed emotions about it. He feels like too many people play it. I don't want to ask him. And Chank says, listen, bro, he goes, Dwayne was my friend before Greg was. And he goes, I'm going to tell Greg that you should be playing that guitar. I said, all right. I said, look, Chank, if you're offering to step up for me, if anyone's going to talk to Greg, real talk, it's you. So, I'm going to step back and thank you for having that conversation. And he did. And not only that, but he got Greg on the phone later that day. And Greg's like, man, I didn't know you wanted to play my brother's guitar. You should have just asked me. I'll let you play it anytime. So then they brought it to the gig. And I was, every time I played that guitar with Greg, I was ultra respectful of its provenance. And, you know, we never would announce that it was coming on stage or anything. It's just, I was very cool about it, and I would pick certain songs. If we played Dreams or Whipping Post or Trouble No More, there were certain songs where I was like, all right, I'd tell, you know, one of our stage techs, like, bring the gold tap out on these songs. And then they'd bring it out and I'd play it. And the first time I did was, I'll never forget it. It was on Trouble No More. And man, Greg sang that first line and I answered it with the slide. And it was like someone put a shock right up my spine.
Wow.
It was like I was, you know, 12 years old in my bedroom listening to that record. And there was that sound, that bridge pickup with that glass slide on it. You know, there it was with that voice.
Do you have the chorus
bottle? Oh yeah, man. I got real ones. I was ready.
Yeah.
You know, I was always thinking about that teenage kid in the crowd, because I was that kid, you know. Who's this motherfucker trying to play with Greg Allman? That was how I always approached the gig. You know, I still do take it dead serious that I was even part of that, because that's the only way you can play that music is like, it's the only thing that matters on earth when you're doing it.
Because I'm sure you're, you know, everybody is standing there with arms crossed, just checking you out.
As they should be. My attitude was always as they should be.
Songwriting with Greg too, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been writing songs since I was a kid, and Greg kind of he got a hold of some of my records. He actually asked me one day, "Hey, man, can you put your solo albums on my phone?" Because somebody had played him a couple things that he liked, and he had a new iPhone, and he had me hook it up to his laptop, and I did it. He didn't have any other music in there, so I just put all my music in there. I synced it with the phone. I handed it back to him. Well, like a month later, we did a tour. We went on the road. We went home. A month or so later, we're back on the road. And one day, Chank comes to get me at a venue, and he goes, "Scott, you got to come to Greg's dressing room." And I'm getting all nervous, like, "Oh shoot, what does Greg want?" And I get in the dressing room, and he goes, "He's playing one of my records really loud." And he goes, "Man," he goes, "Is that you singing?" I said, "Yeah, it's my record." He's like, "God damn it, you're never singing in my band." I said, "I'm sorry, Greg, you don't like it." He's like, "Man, you sing your goddamn ass off. I'm not letting you sing on my stage." Anyway, he was kidding me. But he goes, "Man, I love this song." And then he picks up his guitar and he'd start figuring out some of my songs.
Oh, nice.
And I said, "Son of a bitch, just, I never imagined this happening." And then I looked at his phone and I go, "Greg, what have you been listening? You've been listening to a lot of music." He goes, "Yeah, man, check this song out." And he hits it. And none of these things had IDs, right? Just said track one, track two, whatever. Well, it turns out he was listening to all my records. He thought they were different records.
Oh.
So anyway, we heard music in a similar way is what I'm trying to say. And we heard things, you know, we had a lot of the same influences, and it kind of opened up the floor. And once that was opened up, he was like, "Man, we should try to write some stuff together." And he told me, "First, I want to sing some of your songs." The first song, which is a longer story, but "Love Like Kerosene," which we ended up recording not once but twice, was an older song of mine that he picked up off one of my records. There was another one of mine called "Endless Road" that he worked on for a while. And then in the process of him learning those, I just kept flying down to his house in Savannah, Georgia, and we started writing. We wrote a blues song called "Everything a Good Man Needs" that I ended up actually recording on my last record with Taj Mahal.
Oh wow.
Yeah. That was a fun track. So that's on my record, "Saving Grace."
I got to put that on here, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun. And Bernard Purdy's playing drums on that as well.
I don't need no invitation. I know where I belong. I don't need no confirmation. I've been knowing you much too long. Your love is like no other. It sure enough satisfies me.
But My Only True Friend was the only song that we finished writing together that Greg actually sang on a record. He sang Kerosene, of course, but we didn't write that together. So our only collaboration that he sang on a record was True Friend. And
gotcha.
That one went on to get nominated for an Americana Grammy. And we lost it to the best guy I know, Jason Isbell. So I've never been happier for a loss, to be honest.
Well, just to get nominated is still a big deal.
You know? I agree, and I think that, you know, really I'm so blown away by that, the My Only True Friend, that song, by like the process, like the inspiration I had for it, and then where Greg ended up taking it, and the fact that now people play that song. I mean, I get messages all the time where people are playing that song at funerals and memorials. Mm. And it's become this like sort of, you know, this song of a really like, I don't know if there's as melancholy and mourning, but also like there's a hope and redemption that Greg put in it with his vocal and the place he was at in life. That performance that he has, which was one take with the band on the floor, it's still, I can't listen to it. It cuts too close, but I do play and sing the song regularly with my band, if nothing else, just because I feel like I'm probably the only other guy who can actually play it with the sense of place, that's left as of now. We'll see if that song gets reinvented and future generations, and if it has legs, but I'm really proud of it.
You and I both know this river will surely flow to an end. Keep me in your heart, keep your soul. By the music of my soul, when I'm gone, please don't fly away and find you a new love. I can't face living this life alone. I can't bear to think this might be the end.
And we had a great run, man. I mean, I can't tell you how much I love the guy. I think about him every day. And and our band, the Greg Allman Band, is really close, man. I mean, he made a family. I call it my New York Memphis family, because half the band was from Memphis and half the band was from New York.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, now you're a member of Little Feet, and it's amazing. Those guys are still touring. I mean, well, we lost Paul and Richie, who I knew really well. Richie actually played on one of my solo records, and Kenny Gradney. I actually just had Thanksgiving dinner with him 3 days ago, because he's my really close friends here, producer friend of mine. It's his golf buddy. They're like, they play golf like every 2 days.
And he loves his golf, man.
I see Kenny all the time. Yeah. And I knew those guys back from 20 years ago, Neville Brothers. And what a great group of guys, man. I mean, Tackett. And so I'm so happy that you joined up with them. And hopefully 2021 will present more opportunities, man. This year's just been kind of sucked for timing for you. But, you know, there's always next year. Hopefully you got some things on the books there.
Yeah,
I mean, Kenny said there was a lot of stuff that was supposed to happen this year.
I mean, for both my solo band and Little Feet, I mean, I had just gotten my first major booking agent for my band in March of 2020 of all times. How about that for timing? and that agency is now furloughed until further notice. So there you go. With Little Feet, we were planning a really busy year, but you know, it's really interesting what this year has given the Little Feet camp, because my friend Tony Leone has joined the band now on drums, and from Chris Robinson's Brotherhood, and he was with Ola Bell, with Amy Helm, And I think you're going to see a very interesting sort of evolution of the band come to pass, because we've been recording all year and writing. And I tell you what, man, Bill is writing some great stuff. I've been writing a bunch of stuff. Bill and Tony are even working on a song. Fred and I are working on a thing right now. I think, you know, once we all get back together, which, you know, God willing, we're hoping for the spring right now. And we definitely have a record in the chamber. I mean, it's coming together. I'd say we're about halfway there material wise. So
that's great.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic about it. I mean, the guys are, I tell you, man, I mean, they're not spring chickens, but they're in great fucking shape and they're playing the best I've ever heard them play. Yeah. I played several gigs with them before the shit hit the fan, you know, and they were kicking my ass, man. You know, they're not fucking around. I mean, Little Feet, you know, as your listeners will know who are familiar, and if you're not, get hip, because some people aren't. But I mean, Little Feet is all about elite musicianship. It doesn't get any more elite than rock and roll. I mean, they're right in there with Led Zeppelin and the Allman Brothers and all those bands that we know so well for being the best musicians and making classic songs and records. I mean, having the whole enchilada. I mean, they're one of those bands.
Well, I'm sure you're hip to who Ted Templeman is. I'm sure you are. I just read the book that he wrote. Ted Templeman was for the listeners, he was a producer for Warner Brothers, and his big claim to fame is he produced all the Van Halen records with David Lee Roth, but he also produced a few Little Feet records, all the Doobie Brothers, the big, big, huge records. He was just a phenomenal producer, and he has a book out, and there's many chapters devoted to Little Feet and Little George stories. And I was actually asking Kenny about it, and you know, he was interested because he didn't know about the book, but some great stories in there.
Yeah, I read that book earlier this year, and I told Bill Payne about it. He was excited to read it because, you know, Bill was the session piano player on all the Doobie Brothers stuff, most of it anyway, and a lot of Ted's projects. Bill was the first call, Linda Ronstadt, a bunch of stuff, and he has great things to say. Everyone has great things to say about Ted. I mean, that's. But, you know, we're back to how we started our conversation. I mean, that scene, as you read in the Templeman book at Warner Brothers under Mo Austin, was a real salon of talent. I mean, that's like some Gertrude Stein rock and roll shit right there. I mean, go make your music, fellas. We'll take care of the rest. You know, and when anybody wants to know, you know, when people ask, like, why isn't there a Sgt. Pepper's anymore or you know, any of these kind of records? Well, it's like, you know, or Dark Side of the Moon or... I mean, you know, it takes a year or two to make one of those, you know, and now it's like, you got to make a record, you know, either in your bedroom for 2 years where you can't do anything that those things afford, or you got to make it in 2 days in one of those studios, you know?
You keep a pretty busy schedule. I mean, what are you doing this year? You know, you were doing teaching. You're doing a lot of teaching too. If somebody wants to hit you up for lessons, do you do that like Skype or something?
Man, I've been teaching on and off for 20 years, you know, and particularly already in the last few years, I was doing Zoom or, you know, Skype, whatever application, but I was doing online lessons. And I really got inspired by the True Fire Company because next year I'm going to start my fourth video series with them. And I have a channel with them that people subscribe to. And they kind of, you know, kickstarted me back into it a couple years ago. And honestly, in 2020, I was going to be on the road and producing records and working on records so much that I was not going to have any time to teach. And then when this happened in March with COVID, I just turned to my team, who I work with for promoting my stuff online. And I said, look, you know, either we're all going off the payroll and going on unemployment, or I've got to teach every week because there aren't going to be any gigs till any foreseeable future. And lucky for me, you know, I work with some really talented people at True Fire, and also, you know, my friend Katie Sexton, who handles all my social media. And we just went in head first, and I've been teaching, you know, over 20 hours a week every week since March. And it's...
Wow, 20 hours a week.
It's kept my... Wow. I tell you what, man, I've got two little kids, and it's kept everything going here. I mean, it's been a really decent year, and we've done some gigs. I did a whole online concert series, solo acoustic, over the summer that did very well. My fans were very generous. And then we did several gigs with my band in the tri-state area, in the New York area, in sort of August, September, October, when the weather was better. And they were also phenomenal. I mean, they were all socially distanced and they were difficult to pull off and they were all outside, but they did great. They did great financially. People showed up, they respected the rules, but now, you know, we're going back into, not lockdown, but we're in New York. Is we've had a lot of stumbling blocks, but we're in kind of, I would call it a somewhat flawed, enlightened state of mitigation. So we're kind of, because I just found out schools are opening full time next week, which, you know, they're making some decisions based on science, which I think is prudent. But I think the decisions based on economics have been entirely lacking here. And the music industry has been a victim of that, especially when the weather was warmer. I think we got screwed. Because, you know, the outdoor stuff could have been much more robust. But the science hadn't caught up yet. So you have to be, you know, you have to be cautious with all this stuff, because especially my fans, you know, I don't want them getting this. You know, you got to be really careful, but it's been a good year nonetheless, with the teaching. So, yeah, and I'm still doing it now. And I don't just teach guitar. I teach songwriting. I teach voice. I take them all equally seriously, you know.
How many records do you have, Scott, total, solo records?
Well, I don't have any that have made any money. And I don't have any that probably anybody owns. But I'm working on my sixth solo album now. But and the new one, you know, I guess everyone says this about their new one, but I really do feel like it's the best collection of songs I've ever gotten together. And I've gotten to use my road band on it, Eric Kalb on drums and Brett Bass on bass, who you may know those guys from New York. I love Eric. But so we've been a band for a few years now, and I got to use them on the record. My friend Craig Dreyer joined the band last year. He plays B3 organ, and he also plays the hell out of the saxophone, man. So that's been my little four-piece band. So I've used them on my records. My first time I've ever used one of my road bands on a record of my own. In the past, I've either played all the instruments or I've used incredible session musicians. Like my last album, Saving Grace, that came out in 2018, half the record was David Hood and Spooner Oldham, with Chad Gamble on drums from Isbell's band. And then the other half was the actual high rhythm section with the Hodges brothers and Howard Grimes. So I've been really lucky. And then Charlie Drayton and Sean Pelton have done a lot of my drum tracks. Actually, Charlie, I always try to work with Charlie whenever I can. I got Charlie Drayton on this record we're doing. He came in and did one song.
Has he still got that big car?
No, man, he's a dad now. You know, he's very practical. You know, he's got.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen him in, it's been 3-4 years. No, I don't really know him that well, but
yeah, he's got a child, man, in the New York City school system, and he's living up in Riverdale, and he's still one of the most profoundly talented musicians I've ever known, man. I don't know anybody who can play a song better than Charlie Drayton, even if you hand him a fucking cardboard box with a wire on it. Yeah, I mean, that guy exudes music. And when you're on a session date with him and he's at his apex, which I've been lucky to have on some of my records over the years, and I've been working with him on and off for over 20 years, it's so inspiring, man. You walk away from that session just learning so much. It goes back to what I was talking about, you know, earlier in the conversation. I've just been really, really, really lucky to work with these musicians, man. And I try in every second to not take it for granted and just enjoy it and learn from it. It's such an incredible experience, you know?
want to thank you for doing this again, yet again. I believe the saying is second time's a charm, or if it's not, I just made that up.
I mean, whatever, these days, whatever works, man, whatever gets you through the night, you know?
Yeah. I downloaded a brand new podcast thing, software, just to check this out. So my manager is always telling me, you know, you really need to get some software, podcast software, you know, and start doing this remotely. I was like, man, I hate doing it remotely. I don't like doing these episodes, because if I was sitting with you right now, we'd be jamming and it'd be so much more fun, but that's just the way it is, you know?
Boy, man, maybe we could do a part two and do a little jam when we meet up in one of these places, absolutely. You know?
Yeah, I'm being optimistic, but thank you. Thanks again, Scott, for this. And everybody check out Scott. And I'm sure your website, I'll put all those links on there like I always do.
Thanks for doing this show, and thanks for having me, man. I'm a big fan of the show. I just listened to the G.E. Smith one like a month or two ago, and I loved it, man. You just like, that was such a great interview with him. It was so spot on, and I learned so much I didn't know about him already. It was really cool.
Yeah, I did too, actually. I feel like, standing in his shoes, there's a lot I wanted to know about him.
No, it was so great to hear you guys talk, man. It was it was a great episode.
Oh, thanks, man. He's a good dude.
Yeah.
All right, Scott. Well, I guess we'll see each other. Hopefully our paths cross in 2021.
Yeah, man. Good luck out there with the lockdown. I don't know what's going on with that, but, you know, I'm pulling for you guys.
Yeah, thanks, man.
I hope you can at least still go get a good taco still.
Oh, you can do that.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, have one for me, man. Maybe we'll do that together one day.
All right, bro.
All right, bro. Take care.
All right, there you have it. If you're still here, thanks for listening, hanging in there. What a great interview. Scott, thanks again. Check him out, everybody. ScottSherrard.com. Last name is Sharrard. And look for him hopefully later this year if Little Feet goes out, or check out his solo band, Solo Records. And catch you next time on the Riff Raff.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.